Well, I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah.
Oh, Jeff Buckley. His song, singing Hallelujah, one of the songs that is talked about by the author of the book that we are going to be visiting about over the next hour, and the book's titled, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. And lucky to have Daniel Levitin with us. Daniel's award-winning neuroscientist, musician, best-selling author. I think he has 4 bestsellers. His research is about music, the brain, health, productivity, and creativity. It's a fascinating read. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Let us know how music has maybe helped you heal. Which songs bring back maybe a specific memory for you? What kind of music do you play maybe to unwind after a long day or to get you going? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Daniel, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. Nice to see you again.
I tell you what, I realize you know a lot of people in the music business.
I know Larry Myler.
A lot of people are featured. A lot of songs are featured in the book. And I'm just going to mention right up front, if you get a copy of his book or if you have it, just before the first chapter, you can scan to listen to the music that's featured in the book. And we'll be playing a few pieces as we go along today.
That's really fun.
we'll give it a shot. You're a neuroscientist and a musician.
That's what they tell me.
How'd you get interested in these fields, which on the face of it seem so different?
You know, it's a good question. I was always interested in science and always interested in music, and I was lucky to have school teachers who didn't force me to choose between the two, all the way through elementary school and high school and then college. I was a double major in college, and it was only when I went to graduate school that I realized I could combine the two. My advisor, Michael Posner, said, you're studying the brain and you could start studying the brain on music.
Yeah, why not? And so is that why you wrote this book? Why did you write this book about music as medicine?
You know, I realized as a working neuroscientist that the field had learned quite a bit in the last 10 years about how music can impact psychological and physical health, how it can be used, certain kinds of music in certain situations can be used to treat a variety of ailments and diseases, disorders. And most of that information had not trickled down to the public. It was stuck in dusty old journals in libraries. And I just wanted to share that knowledge with music lovers, but also with public policymakers, to get hospital administrators, even government officials, aware of the cost savings and the now proven benefits of music for a wide range of health applications.
And this book's been out now a year, is it? Somewhere around there.
Yeah, and today is the day when the paperback comes out.
Yeah.
And so people can get it for less money than the hardback, and it's easier to carry around.
And I have a copy of it in my hot little hand right now. And I really enjoyed reading it. And the feedback, what's the feedback been like?
Oh, well, it's been tremendously gratifying, Larry. From musician friends and even people I didn't know. Paul McCartney, for example, He used to have a band called Wings, and before that he had a band called the Beatles, if any of you have heard of him. He had read an advance copy of the book through his publisher, and he liked it so much that he contributed a quote to the back of the book. So that, you know, all that was very gratifying. And the quote was effectively that he'd wondered his whole life, why is it that music, which is just a bunch of frequencies, you know, like, and yeah. And he does it like this, boop, 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 boop. You know, it's just a bunch of frequencies, but when they're arranged in a particular way, they can bring us profound sadness or joy. They can alter our mood. How is it that that happens? And he says the book explains that.
We just spent an hour talking with Doug Bradley and Craig Werner about the songs of the Vietnam War. And they wrote and I think they've talked with you, may have visited with you about it. We got to get out of this place. The soundtrack of the Vietnam War was their book. And it's sort of,
that's the Eric Burden song, right?
And so music served as medicine then, but it served as medicine a long time back, further than that, has it not?
Well, as far as we know, music's been around as long as humans have. The oldest artifacts we find at human and even Neanderthal burial sites are musical instruments, bone flutes, and hollowed out logs that were used as drums with skin stretched across them. And going back even to the oldest written word we have, which is the Old Testament, there's that lovely passage that Leonard Cohen referenced in his song about how when King Saul, king of the Israelites, would fall into a depression, he would summon a young minstrel named David, who later became king and who later slew the giant Goliath. But David was called upon to play the lyre and bring Saul out of his depression so that he could govern the country.
Well, how much is music, we talk about music therapy here a bit, how much is music therapy more than just listening to music that makes you feel good?
Well, so I would make a kind of a technical distinction here between music therapy and a music intervention. So music therapy is practiced by music therapists, which is a certification that people get by studying it as a field. They are therapists who have learned to use music. And music therapy takes many forms. It's usually a dyadic relationship, a patient and a therapist, or it could be group therapy, but there's a therapist involved who may ask the patient or patients to engage in group drumming or singing or songwriting, or may prescribe, as it were, particular songs to achieve a therapeutic goal. That's different than, say, a music intervention, which is when I wanted to get through my exercise workout this morning. I'm not a music therapist, but I knew that if I listened to Van Halen, I would be able to exercise a little longer and harder than usually. And last night when I was having trouble going to sleep, I put on some Bach partitas and that relaxed me. And that's all of us. We know from surveys in my lab, most people in the Western world use music in this way as some sort of medicine.
Let's go to the basics here. How does sound interact with our bodies and make its way to our brain?
But that's really fascinating. So the only way you get sound into your brain is through the eardrums and bone conduction. And sound either comes out of loudspeakers or out of something that made the sound, like a tube that somebody blew through, a clarinet, or a string that somebody plucked on a guitar, something, or your vocal cords is also a tube like a clarinet, but it comes out of your mouth. The sound sets up a disturbance in the molecules in the atmosphere. And those molecules eventually make their way to your eardrum and cause it to wiggle in and out. And then from that wiggling in and out, a whole bunch of electrical activity happens in neurons that try to reconstruct what in the world was it that caused that particular wiggling in and out. Was it Van Halen or was it Enya? Was it Bach? And you know, it's really extraordinary that just from that, the brain can reverse engineer what happened, and you can pick out an oboe from a cello, or you can recognize Johnny Cash's voice in an instant, and it's all happening in the brain at that point.
And where does it happen in the brain? It happens in, there's not a specific spot, is there?
It's a difficult question.
Yeah,
it'd be like asking, where is gravity in your studio? Well, it's distributed.
Yeah,
I mean,
all over.
It's sort of everywhere, but if you were to drop that microphone, it would drop in a particular place. So music in the brain is distributed. There are specialized circuits for things like detecting pitch or rhythm. There are specialized circuits that keep track of lyrics or predict what's going to come next in a song. In fact, music activates every part of the brain that we've so far mapped. And I'm not even talking about things like dancing to music, which is kind of automatic.
I think you mentioned even sleep.
Yes. Yeah.
Every part of our brain. Georgia in Madison has something. Let's go there. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. My partner had a major right brain stroke in 2014 in his right median artery, and he's paralyzed on the left and walks with great difficulty and with a quad cane with somebody helping him along. But he discovered recently that he walks better with music, and particularly Wilson Pickett and Johnny Cash. And Johnny Cash has got a song called Get Rhythm, and Mustang Sally works pretty well. I wondered if your guest had an insight into why that works.
Yeah.
So this is well known among the neuroscience community. I devote a whole chapter to it, Music for Movement. And I talk about the case of people with Parkinson's, but it applies more generally. Often people with Parkinson's disease lose the ability to walk. And the reason is that the disease attacks the very cells, the brain cells, the neurons, that coordinate voluntary movements, like putting one foot in front of the other. And one of the consequences is that timing circuit that, you know, it's not just putting one foot in front of the other, but at a steady pace to walk smoothly and continuously. But if we play music that has the tempo of your normal walking speed, within about 5 seconds, the brain synchronizes to that beat, the intact parts of the brain, and then they take over for the damaged part of the brain and allow somebody to walk smoothly and continuously, even after the music stops playing.
That's amazing. Georgia, thank you very much for calling. And maybe Kate and Eau Claire has something that may relate. Let's go there. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Oh, thank you. I'm so glad. I didn't think I'd get on. My mother had dementia for a long time, and I would take her generation of music to listen to. We were sitting in the dining room one time. People who were like in the awakening, catatonic, being fed. The women, when this Gershwin tune started up with, don't be a naughty baby, come to papa, do. Lifted their spoons in the air, sang along, and went back to being catatonic. It was phenomenal. And I had just one other short comment about tunes like Paco Bell's Canon that has rising and descending notes. Someone reflected that might have something to do with the heartbeat in utero, if you could comment on that so many people are attracted to that type of passage in music. Thank you. I'll hang up.
Oh, thank you very much for calling, Kate. Well, a couple of things there.
Well, so Paco Bell's Canon is much loved.
It is indeed.
Often played at the tempo of about a heartbeat. One of the first things the infant hears, of course, is the developing infant in the womb, is the mother's heartbeat. We now know that the auditory system of the developing infant is fully functional by 20 weeks. And so they're hearing all sorts of stuff from the outside world and the heartbeat. And I don't know why that ascending pattern, bum, 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 bum. It's just, I don't know why that's so compelling, but it is. Probably because it outlines the chords that it's playing, and it allows the listener to be an active participant in recreating the arpeggio into a tonal center. The Alzheimer's case is very interesting, and I devote a chapter in my book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, to that. My colleague Oliver Sacks worked on a film called Alive Inside, and there's a wonderful example there, many of you will have seen it, of a catatonic patient who's been on the ward in Brooklyn for a couple of months and hasn't said a word. And then Oliver brings in an iPod, because iPods were new back then, and plays him some Cab Calloway songs from his youth. And he perks up and he sings along, and he then becomes loquacious and starts talking for the first time. I think the way I describe it in the book is this. The difficulty with profound memory loss, Alzheimer's, dementia, is that the stricken individuals at some point no longer recognize their loved ones. They don't know where they are. And they might not even recognize themselves in a mirror. And in the face of such profound disorientation, they often turn inward because the outside world makes no sense. And then the music brings them back because those memories are intact. Memories from your teenage years are the last to go.
Hmm. Daniel Levitin, our guest today, as we talk with him about his book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. And you can join in with your own experiences or questions. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Imagine. One of the songs that is discussed in Daniel Levitin's book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. And, you know, music is more than just listening, as I listen to that song. And you found that listening to music stimulates a visual imagery in the brain, does it not?
It does. Not for everybody and not in all circumstances. But one thing is that typically when we have people in a brain scanner and they're listening to music, we see activity in the visual centers of the brain. It's in the back of the head, visual cortex, occipital lobe, for those of you keeping track. And we ask them what's going on. I say, well, I'm picturing James Brown dancing and singing at the same time. Or a particular song evoked images of a beach or a landscape, or another song evoked images of my grandfather because he loved that song. And so music, you know, we talked before the break about how music activates every part of the brain. It's a really good retrieval cue for memories. It's like Proust had written about the Madeleine cookie, bringing back a flood of memories, and if smells do that, music brings these things back.
Bill in Madison has something for us that may relate to this. Bill, hi.
Hi. Very much so. I had in 1999 a traumatic brain injury. It was a subdural, a full brain bleed, and I was in ICU. They put me into a light coma. When I came out, I mean, it's been a struggle, but what all of a sudden when I was home and I'm watching TV and the theme of Barney Miller came on, which I watched as a kid, it was like all these lights went off. It was just amazing, the circuitry in my brain. And my therapist, he said, well, yeah, your computer is starting to reboot. And ever since then, I mean, you know, I put on Simon and Garfunkel, all this stuff. I was a drummer, and all of a sudden I find myself moving to the beat. Absolutely incredible. And then I went out dancing again. Oh, my God. And I tell people, I said, if you ever go into a room and somebody's in a coma, though, I think the best thing you can do, bring in music they love. And I think you mentioned that earlier, but it was just, and still is, amazing.
Bill, thank you for calling. Comment, Daniel?
Well, we now appreciate that pretty much every experience you've ever had that was meaningful to you is in your brain somewhere. The problem is finding it. It's your brain is not that well organized. It's like a filing cabinet drawer that's got a bunch of files that are labeled, but then a whole bunch more that are unlabeled, or they have the wrong labels on them. And then there's just a whole bunch of papers thrown in there that nobody ever bothered to file. And so every once in a while, if you get the right cue, is what we call it in my business, the right probe, you find that file. And in general, the most resilient memories are those that are the oldest. Computer scientists talk about first in, last out. And that's the principle. The earlier memories stay intact. And as we age, we sometimes regress to our younger age because those are the only memories we have.
Speaking of memories, you tell a good story about Ella Fitzgerald in the book Singing Mac the Knife. Tell that story. You have so many, by the way, you have so many wonderful stories to illustrate what you're talking about with things that have happened to people and how they have progressed or maybe not progressed, but mostly progressed when they use music. But talk about Ella Fitzgerald and Mac the Knife.
Yeah, well, so, you know, I like reading popular books about science and world affairs, and I like reading, about contemporary political books. But to me, a good story can make a point better than just the dry facts. Now, the dry facts are important, but they're dry. A good story has a kind of relatability that the cold facts don't. And so you're asking how I came to write the book earlier. I read about 4,000 journal articles, and they're all cited in the back of the book there in small type, but they're there. And so this is all based on science. But if I could find a story that would illustrate a principle, I felt that it would get the point across better if I got the right story. And Ella is an example of that. She did a concert in Berlin in 1959 or 60, I forget now, and live show, and she forgot the words to Mac the Knife. And because she was a consummate performer, and was always thinking about the audience experience rather than her own experience, you know, how can I entertain? How can I keep the show going? The show must go on, right?
Yeah.
So realizing that she forgets the lyrics, she doesn't say, oh, let's stop and start over again. Or does somebody have the lyrics? She just keeps going, and she improvises lyrics on the spot. And some of the lyrics are, I'm making a wreck of Mac the Knife, or this part I don't remember. But she manages to generate, I mean, this is very early freestyle, very early. I mean, it's not rapping because she's keeping the melody, but it's, you know, a very early example of freestyling poetry where she maintains the rhyme scheme of the original song and maintains the rhythm and all of the accents and the melody. She just doesn't know the words. But it's a marvelous example of the capacity of the human mind to remember some things and not others. So she forgot the words, but she remembered the sentiment. She remembered there was something about a tugboat down by a river. You know, I mean, she remembered certain things and not others. And I just, you know, I find that fascinating.
I do as well. Music is a gateway to accessing memories. You know, how can music help us pull out memories that are so difficult to locate?
Well, it doesn't work with all music. It works with music that's associated with a particular experience you had. So maybe there was that summer, Larry, when you were 13 years old and there was a particular song that you liked and you and your friends listened to it all the time. Or maybe you were carpooling to a softball game and it was, that was always on the radio because back in those days, a top 40 station meant they only played 40 records.
Yeah.
They played them over and over and over again. So if you haven't heard the song regularly since then, it's uniquely associated with a time and a place and all the friends you were with and the things you were doing. And that's how music can evoke the memory. It wouldn't work so well with a song like Happy Birthday or the National Anthem, which we hear in so many different contexts. It works best when a song is associated with a particular context. It's why if you break up with somebody, a romantic partner, and then years later you hear that song that was our special song, it can reduce you to a puddle of tears.
Yeah, it can. It can indeed. Jay and Two Rivers, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. When I was young, and you can imagine how old I am now, the three most important things in high school were having a girlfriend, a working car, and a stereo. Back then, though, my stereo was only mono, and it used vacuum tubes. And up until, maybe the last 5-10 years, it was important to have a good car stereo. But now driving is stimulating enough that I don't really need the music. And though I have a good stereo that still uses vacuum tubes, I don't listen to it as much. And I'm wondering if it's just me or if it's common as one ages to access music less often.
Hmm. Is it less important for us as we age, or for some at least?
I think we go through phases of life where some things are more important and some things are less. And I don't know that it's necessarily a function of aging. We have other things to occupy our time when we get older. We might have grandchildren or hobbies or things. We feel that we have less time, and if we don't really love listening to music, we're not going to spend the time doing it. It also can be hard to find music that's, it's easy to get tired of things you've been listening to for 50 years, and it can be hard to find new music that you like. The streaming stations, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, Pandora, are not quite there yet, but they're getting pretty good at making recommendations. So I hop in the car and I throw Spotify on, particularly if I'm in traffic and I'm bored. And it's got a playlist for me every day, and it's based on what I've listened to. And a good number of those songs are things I've never heard before. Some of them I don't like, but some I just discovered Claro this way. A new singer. She's nominated for a Grammy, I believe, C-L-A-I-R-O. I just love her. Young singer. I discovered Jacob Collier that way. And, I think the act of discovery is something that is neuroprotective and healthful. So whether you're discovering new books or new friends or new music, it's something that can help stave off the effects of aging, which is the topic of my previous book just before this one, Successful Aging.
Why is it so? Music seems much easier to remember. I mean, just an hour ago, we were playing all these songs from the 60s and the 70s, and I think I could come pretty close to the words on every one of the ones that we played.
So from a cognitive science standpoint, music is what we would call a highly structured stimulus. Think of the game tic-tac-toe versus chess. Tic-tac-toe has a lot of constraints, which is why kids love to play it and adults less so. We grow out of it. Chess has so many fewer constraints that it's a game you can play at a very high level for the rest of your life. Music is more like chess. More like tic-tac-toe than chess. It can be as stimulating as chess, but it has constraints, meaning that the mutually reinforcing cues of rhythm and accent structure and meter and tempo, plus the semantics of the song. If it's a song about cars, you know there's going to be driving and maybe somebody having trouble getting off a seatbelt or whatever it is. Referring to a Chuck Berry song, of course. The idea is that even if you don't remember every single word, it's probably going to be easy to recreate the song.
Oh, Jay, thanks. Rob, a certified NICURN, loves the topic of conversation we're having here. He just wanted to clarify for listeners the auditory structures and the ability to hear some low frequencies is intact at about 20 weeks gestation. However, the auditory system is not fully developed till 28 weeks gestation, when it gains the ability to hear a wider range of frequencies and the connections between the thalamus and auditory cortex have become more mature. So he's referring back to something you were talking about earlier. A listener emailed us, does music help heal damage to or deterioration of the cerebellum?
We don't know how to cure damage to any brain structure, but the brain is massively redundant. It has a lot of supplementary pathways. And so cerebellar damage, which can cause difficulty with emotion perception and with movements, either voluntary or involuntary movements, swallowing is an involuntary movement, for example, walking is voluntary. You can't repair damage to the cerebellum, but you can use music to restore some functionality for motivation or for coordinating movement, for synchronizing movements. And music can also restore some sense of emotion when people become flat emotionally, effectively what we call anhedonic from cerebellar damage, because music can be so powerfully emotional. And it can activate supplementary motion circuits in the frontal lobes.
Anne in Marshfield, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Anne.
Hello, fellows. It's nice to talk to you.
Thanks for joining in.
I wanted to ask the researcher, did you research Ronald Reagan? I understand toward the end of his presidency, he would check out and something would trip him and he would check back in. And it was a precursor of his eventual Alzheimer's, of course. But I wondered if you checked on his life at all.
Well, I did for my previous book, For Successful Aging, because I had known his Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury, George Shultz, since the 1980s. And Shultz was very close with Reagan and visited him even after he left the presidency. And Shultz was aware of some lapses in President Reagan's attention and memory. You may recall there was a widely reported incident where President Reagan thought that he'd been a pilot in the war. And in fact, that was, he was remembering a role that he had played in a film, and it didn't actually happen to him. A mistake that many actors might make and many might not. But back in those days, in the 80s, people weren't as aware of the course of Alzheimer's or how to diagnose it and assess it. So from what I understand from Secretary Shultz, President Reagan was really in command up to the end of his presidency. But yeah, he would go in and out. But I got to tell you, when I was 20 years old, I would go in and out. And as a professor who teaches 20-year-olds, I can tell you, they're not always engaged in all there either. So it's not just aging.
No, you're absolutely right about that. Oh, my goodness. And that's why all my years of teaching, I would tell stories that would seem to re-engage folks along the way. And you had to do that about every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
About every 10 minutes.
Professor Tricks.
To re-engage. Well, dementia, you say dementia, in your book, affects multiple systems of the brain's machinery, intricate machinery. And music stimulates the damaged brain's language network.
Yeah, so perhaps a story is the best way to illustrate this. And that's Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot in the language areas of the brain and could not speak. But she underwent a course of therapy, music therapy, where she learned to sing what she needed to say. Things like, I need to go to the bathroom, or please get a glass of water. You know, normal daily life necessities. And through the act of singing, which she could do, she was able to scaffold on the language centers and eventually learn to speak without singing. So again, it gets back to this idea we were talking about, Larry, where there's a multiple redundancy in the brain, multiple systems accomplish similar or identical things. And it's the matter of finding the right circuit that you can use to supplement a damaged circuit. I kind of think of it like this. If you've got a broken outlet in your living room and you still need a lamp, you just get an extension cord and you plug it into another outlet. The electricity is still there. It's just not where you thought it was.
You have a great story, and you were friends with Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you'd relate that story, because it relates to what we're just talking about here.
So I'd known Joni since 1996, and as was widely reported, in March of 2015, she suffered a burst aneurysm and a brain bleed, and she was put into the emergency room where she stayed for 3 months. And the damage caused by the aneurysm, which is effectively a hemorrhagic stroke, was deemed to be incurable. She was sent home without any follow-up care. And I went and visited her within a few days of her being out of the hospital when she was first able to see visitors. And it seemed as though she was responding to music coming from the other room that the nurses were listening to. Now, she couldn't walk, she couldn't talk, she couldn't even respond by shaking her head at that point. But she kind of perked up when she heard music. So we started playing her music that we knew she loved. And within a few weeks, she regained a kind of consciousness, like we were talking about earlier, half an hour ago, with the Alzheimer's patients. She regained a sort of connection to what was going on in the world, and she started bobbing her head along with the music. And that was all I needed to know to call in a neurologist and a physical therapist, a speech therapist, cognitive therapist, to get her walking and talking and singing again.
It was an amazing, amazing story to me, and good on you.
I'm glad I was there at the right time.
Oh, man. Our guest today, Daniel Levitin, his latest book, you've got to take a look at it. It's titled, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. And you can join in, too, and I hope you do. What's your experience with music, perhaps as medicine? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, that is our guest today. Is not only a good writer, but he's a good singer and songwriter. And then Levitin's song "Headed for the Fall" we were listening to, and you wrote this and played it. We were just talking about Joni Mitchell, if I'm not mistaken. You wrote this and played this for Joni.
Yeah, we were getting together once a month or so between about 2002 and 2015, and we'd play each other whatever songs we were working on. And she took an interest in my songwriting. And as I was writing it, she helped me to uncover some metaphors for the song that I hadn't realized were there, which is lovely. I mean, I was writing it about being depressed and falling into depression. But she says, you know, heading for the fall, it could also mean Adam and Eve, the fall from grace. It could mean a waterfall. And, you know, heading for the falls, you know, in a boat, the boat's about to go off the deep end. And so just the way she thinks about songwriting and metaphor and allegory helped me not just with that song, but with all my songs since. It was a tremendously enriching experience. And I like to think that I was able to help her some with her songs, which I know that she invited me to help her put together four of her records around that time. And that was a really rewarding experience.
And writing, you do talk in the book about how one of the therapies involves producing music and the what happens in the brain. Well, not only when you're playing an instrument, but when you're writing a song. Something goes on in the brain.
There's this program called Songwriting with Soldiers, among others, where soldiers back from armed conflict with PTSD are paired with professional songwriters, and they take the trauma and they write about it, and that gets it outside their body, and it becomes something more objective, and it stops eating away at them. It's not corroding the vessel that contains them because it's now out in the world. And you don't have to be a professional songwriter to work with a professional songwriter. You express your feelings, they help you shape them. I go once a year to a camp for musicians and aspiring musicians in outside of Nashville, run by Victor Wooten, a great bass player, who's on tour right now with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. I happened to see them yesterday at the Ford Theater in L.A. And Victor and I did a songwriting camp, and there was this girl who was really very depressed named Rachel, and she'd never written a song before. And we, with a group of musicians that were there, drummer, bass player, keyboard player, guitarist, just asked her to talk about her feelings. And every once in a while, Victor or I would latch onto a phrase and we'd say, well, that's something that you could say again in a more musical way. And then the band starts accompanying her. And within about 20 minutes, she had an amazing song that captured what she was feeling. And she felt better. And that effect lingered for months.
Suzanne in Madison has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just turned 69 and been very much a hiker and up and down steep hills and such. But I noticed the last couple of years my legs getting quite sluggish and off pace. And I just naturally started counting 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, and my legs just respond to that and move at the pace that I'm counting. And I can increase the speed of the counting, and my legs just naturally respond, and they stay moving. So somewhat like the beat of a heart or the beat of music. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling. Comments, Daniel?
Self-medication. It works.
It does indeed. Chris in Richland Center, what's on your mind?
I was just going to tell you that I had worked in a nursing home for many years, and we had a phenomenon among residents there called sundowning, and they would get very upset, anxious, irate, and we had one particular woman who would she'd beat the tar out of us every day, and eventually I figured out that when she was calm and relaxed, she was humming to herself and she was singing to herself, and they were lullabies. So I started putting a lullaby on a tape recorder in her room, and I would start playing that a few minutes before we went in to get her up. And as we got her up, I'd say, oh, do you hear the music? And she'd start singing along with it. And we wouldn't get beat up anymore.
Oh.
And it was really nice. But on another tack there, I also know that when I'm cleaning house, the best house cleaning music in the world for me Rolling Stones, Hot Rocks, you just get a wiggle on and you got it done.
And this one chapter, you talk about music in the home, and which gets into the sum of that. So talk about that a bit.
Well, I did a study with Apple and Sonos, the speaker company, where we tried to understand how people use music in the home, and we put wireless Sonos speakers in some people's homes for a week, and then we had them not listen to music for a week. And it was really fascinating. It was a well-controlled study. There was a range of ages and ethnicities and socioeconomic background, countries, even different countries. People who had music playing in the home tended to spend more time together and in closer proximity to one another. We had a kind of these things Apple makes called an eye beacon, where it could tell how close you are to someone else if they're wearing an iWatch. And I'm not advertising for Apple. They're just the ones who funded the study. And because they were interested in the science behind it, people sat closer together. They spent more time together. If there were kids in the house, the kids spent more time helping to prepare a meal and wash up after. And the couples reported having 30% more sexual activity during a week in which music was playing out loud. Maybe they were wiggling to the Rolling Stones. I don't know.
Well, it lets me think that maybe music isn't a bad thing to have in the house if you've got the house full. You know, you come home and the spouse and maybe a couple of kids are there. Music wouldn't be a bad thing to have going.
Well, and the other thing about the Sonos speakers that was unique at the time, and I don't know if other wireless speakers do this because I only know the Sonos, but you can control them in such a way that you can have the same song playing in multiple rooms of the house, or different members of the family can have their own music playing on the Sonos that's in their bedroom or their space. And where you can broadcast your music to other rooms of the house. So like you might be in your office, Larry, and I might be working at your house at the opposite end of the house or the apartment, you know, in another office. And we're just doing our thing. And then a song comes on that I want you to hear. I just broadcast it to your room.
Oh, man. Here we are getting close to the end of the hour. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface. Why should society place value in music? What riches does it offer our lives?
Well, I think for most people, music is an experience that they feel they describe as an essential part of being human. It's an aesthetic experience. It brings great joy and introspective possibilities, great personal growth. But in a more practical way, Larry, I think we're facing a healthcare system with spiraling costs, an aging population, and in many cases, treatments that don't work. And certainly not cost effectively. My favorite example of this is that if you go into surgery, prior to knocking you out, they're going to give you a muscle relaxant, emotional relaxant, maybe Valium. And the way the pharmaceutical hospital complex works is that Valium that you might pay $3 for at the corner drugstore is going to cost $750 in the hospital on average. And we've now seen studies that show that listening to relaxing music prior to surgery is just as effective, at least as effective as the Valium. And it's much cheaper, and there's no addictive consequence. And so.
And no $700 bill.
Exactly right.
Daniel, this is a lovely book. Thank you so much for writing it and for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like to give a shout out to my friend in Madison, Ben Sidran, the great jazz musician.
He's a great, great guy. Daniel Levitin, I heard there was a secret chord, music as medicine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thank you for listening.
Well, it goes like this.